be love. La bonne femme vous écoute en dans tout ce bruit-là.
La bonne femme vous écoute en dans tout ce bruit-là.
A dit en tout ma fille, de ça on n'en meurt pas. Mais au toi d'en ferons pas ça, puis au tes mains de là.
Au toi d'en ferons pas ça, puis au tes mains de là.
A dit en dur ma fille, de ça on n'en meurt pas.
A dit en dur ma fille, de ça on n'en meurt pas.
En tout cas si t'en meurs, et on t'enterrera. Mais au toi d'en ferons pas ça, puis au tes mains de là.
Au toi d'en ferons pas ça, puis au tes mains de là.
En tout cas, si t'en meurs, ben on t'enterrera.
En tout cas, si t'en meurs, ben on t'enterrera.
On marque sur sa tombe, est morte en faisant ça. Mais au toi d'en ferons pas ça, puis au tes mains de là.
Au toi d'en ferons pas ça.
Sa tombe est morte en faisant ça.
On marque sur sa tombe est morte en faisant ça.
En faisant sa prière au pied de Saint-Nicolas. Mais au toi d'en ferons pas ça, puis au tes mains de là.
Au toi d'en ferons pas ça, puis au tes mains de là.
Au toi d'en ferons pas ça, puis au tes mains de là. Au toi d'en ferons pas ça, puis au tes mains de là.
Era un delirio. WRCT Pittsburgh, the last bastion of pulchritude.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we had primaries last night, and as expected, Wyoming Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney has been absolutely brutally defeated in her Republican primary. Did she abandon Republican orthodoxy? Was she pro-choice or against lowering taxes on the rich or any policy? Nope, it wasn't anything like that. She simply said that Donald Trump really did lose the election in 2020. And for that, the MAGA people determined she had to be punished, and she will now be replaced on the November final general election ballot by Harriet Hageman, an individual whose political views are essentially identical to Liz Cheney's, with the exception that Harriet Hageman has parroted the claim that Joe Biden didn't really win in November of 2020. And that apparently was a mortal sin. Let's talk about last night's primaries. As the Associated Press reports, Trump foe Cheney loses Wyoming GOP primary, ponders 2024 bid. I don't even care about the 2024 thing for now. She was on with Savannah Guthrie this morning and sort of said, I'm going to think about 24. There's no real need to talk about that right now. A lot of things will happen between now and then. Liz Cheney, Trump's fiercest Republican adversary, writes the AP, in Congress, soundly lost a Republican primary, falling to a rival backed by the former president in a rout that reinforced his grip on the party's base. The third-term congresswoman and her allies entered Tuesday downbeat about her prospects. And listen, she lost. I mean, I don't even really know what else we need to pull from this. She lost, and she lost very, very significantly. And the reason that she became a target of the MAGA people and of Donald Trump is that she insisted Trump didn't win in 2020. Trump really genuinely lost. She's still a Republican. She still voted the way Trump wanted 93% of the time when she was in Congress and Trump was president. But she says, no, Trump genuinely did lose. And in her concession speech, sort of her speech that she gave, she says, I easily won last time. I could have won again. I just would have had to lie and say that Trump won, and I wasn't willing to do that. Let's listen to what she had to say last night.
2 years ago, I won this primary with 73% of the vote.
True.
I could easily have done the same again. The path was clear. But it would have required that I go along with President Trump's lie about the 2020 election.
Right.
It would have required that I enable his ongoing efforts to unravel our democratic system and attack the foundations of our republic. That was a path I could not and would not take.
The Lincoln Project commented on Liz Cheney's primary loss. That's a group made of sort of non-Trump Republicans for the most part. And they said tonight marks the end of the Republican Party. What remains shares the name of the Republican Party, but it is in fact an authoritarian nationalist cult dedicated only to Donald Trump. So there's really two sides to this. Is it wacky and is it disturbing that this is what the Republican Party has become? Of course it is. Of course it's wacky and disturbing. The goal of the MAGA people is to purge the Republican Party of the critics of Donald Trump, even something as benign as saying the results were the real results. Joe Biden did win. Donald Trump did lose. You've got Adam Kinzinger retiring. Liz Cheney lost her primary. Some of the other Republicans who did vote to convict Trump on that second impeachment trial are either retiring or lost primaries. So it is absolutely crazy that that's the situation. At the same time, it's important to remind you that Liz Cheney mostly voted with Trump. and she's being replaced by someone who will mostly vote in the way that Trump would want, will vote with the Republican Party, whatever. Harriet Hageman will vote the same way as Liz Cheney on just about every issue. The only difference is Hageman is willing to repeat the big lie, whereas Liz Cheney was not. So it's also disturbing because on policy, there is essentially no difference between Hageman and Cheney. They're both against abortion. They're both for, you know, lower taxes for the rich, whatever. The difference is actually just one about this issue where it's about an election that was almost 2 years ago. So that's also sad. Now, these results could potentially backfire, and I'll mention the way in which that could happen. Wyoming's total population is 580,000. No, I'm not saying 580,000 people voted yesterday. I'm not saying there's 580,000 Republicans. The total population of Wyoming is 580,000. Tiny electorate. Much more subject to having a primary manipulated by out-of-state money and Trump and the MAGA people. These results could send a signal to the more reasonable Republicans in other parts of the country, to the extent that they exist, and to a little extent they do, that the Republican Party is now the MAGA Party. And many Republicans aren't at all in favor of this being a MAGA Party. If you're Mitt Romney, for example, it is at this point, thanks to the Democratic Party, that we still even have some semblance of democracy in the United States. But if you're Romney, you should understand that your own party will come for you, at least potentially. And we have to see what the impact is of that on, to the extent that they exist, the more moderate and reasonable Republicans. Now, a couple other elections from last night. Lisa Murkowski also was challenged by a pro-Trump Republican in Alaska in the Senate. She won enough votes to advance to the general election in November in that Senate race. And Sarah Palin, although she did not get the most votes in her Alaska congressional primary yesterday, she also will advance to November. So that's what's going on. And we're going to have it's an open house seat for Sarah Palin. And we will see in November what happens with that. But very disturbing results, that's for sure. Let's now go and talk about the Senate. I have to tell you that the Senate is not looking so bad. Now, we'll look at the general Senate numbers in a moment, but there are three prominent Republicans who, as of right now, are losing their Senate races. Let's talk about them one by one. First and foremost, Val Demings, member of Congress, Democratic member of Congress, former police officer. She has decided to challenge Marco Rubio, the incumbent Republican Florida senator, for his seat. She's currently winning by four. This could go in any direction between now and November, but we're only 2.5 months away. And to be such a longtime incumbent senator as Marco Rubio, sort of a celebrity senator to the extent that he ran for president and he's more well known than, you know, pick whoever, Ben Sasse, I don't know, senators whose names I don't even know. And so the fact that he is down four is not insignificant. As The Hill reports, Val Demings leads Rubio by four, according to a poll released Tuesday. The poll is from University of North Florida's Public Opinion Research Lab. It shows Demings at 48, Rubio at 44, 7% saying they would choose someone else. Now, much of that 7% will ultimately vote for Demings or Rubio. So that is very, very interesting. Now, a couple of other races that are interesting. There is the Mehmet Oz versus John Fetterman race in Pennsylvania in the Senate there. As I've told you before, this is a race that could decide whether Democrats or Republicans control the Senate after the November election. This is not a race that is looking very good for Mehmet Oz, despite all of his personal wealth and cringe ads and everything. The latest Fox News poll has it at Fetterman plus 11. The Fabrizio Anzalone poll has it at Fetterman plus 6. USA Today, Fetterman plus 9. Those aren't particularly new polls. But on average, right now, according to Real Clear Politics, Fetterman leading Oz by, on average, 8.7 points. That's good news for Democrats as well. And then lastly, in Georgia, and this is a really scary one because it is way, way, way too close. In Georgia, incumbent Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock is trying to beat off a challenge from Herschel Walker. Herschel Walker is the Republican nominee who cannot speak, who cannot put together a coherent sentence. And yet somehow, look at these numbers. Warnock, yes, he's leading, but he is leading by only an average of 4.4 points in that race. Walker cannot think and cannot speak. He understands not a single political issue. And he's almost within the margin of error. That is endlessly, endlessly horrifying about what it says about the United States and its electorate. Now, overall, how are things looking for the fall? If we look at the 538 forecast in the Senate, Democrats are now up to a 61% chance of holding the Senate. This is a number that started at roughly 50-50 months ago. And over time, the scenarios have shifted more and more and more in favor of Democrats holding the Senate. Now, 61 in 100 doesn't mean Democrats are likely to have 61 seats, not even close. In fact, as you can see on this graphic, the most likely scenarios are either another 50-50 split with Kamala Harris being the tie-breaking vote, meaning Democrats control, Democrats having 51 seats or 52 seats. Those are the most likely scenarios. But a 61% chance of holding the Senate, when really Republicans should be taking it, historically speaking, is not altogether terrible. And then over in the House of Representatives, the odds have improved just marginally for Democrats, but still roughly a 4-to-1 edge for Republicans. A week or two ago, I told you that Democrats had only a 20% chance of winning the House. That has just barely inched up flaccidly to 22% from 20%. So in all likelihood, Democrats will lose the House. But if indeed they maintain the Senate, they will at least be able to prevent Republicans from doing any serious damage. Now, also in terms of the Senate, North Carolina is in play. Florida, 538 has North Carolina looking similar to Florida in terms of the odds that a Democrat takes that seat. And we are going to continue following all of these numbers. But the most likely scenario, the closer we get, the more we can kind of narrow our prediction. The most likely outcome right now is Democrats hold the Senate, lose the House, and we have just vile obstruction for the next 2 years and nothing gets done. And then Republicans use their own obstruction to try to justify voting for a Republican for president in 2024 because Joe Biden didn't get anything done for those last 2 years, thanks to them, of course. So that's where we are right now. I look forward to taking your questions about the 2022 midterms during our upcoming member-only viewer town hall. We do many wide-open, full-audience viewer town halls. We are holding an exclusive event on Wednesday, August 31 at 6 p.m. Eastern time, where members will be able to call in and chat with me. We will stream the event for everybody, but only members will participate. If you would like to participate, simply sign up at joinpacman.com. Well, another day and another major legislative accomplishment for Joe Biden, whose presidency in the last 2 months, as I told you about yesterday and the day before, has really turned itself around. The Inflation Reduction Act has now been signed into law by President Joe Biden. This bill, you might recall, barely passed the U.S. Senate, 51-50. But sir, how could it add up to 101 votes? Well, it was 50-50 with Kamala Harris as vice president, is the president of the Senate, casting the tie-breaking vote, 51. That was on August 7th. There were no Republican votes. We also saw the bill on Friday pass the U.S. House, not particularly widely, by a 220 to 207 margin. And Joe Biden has now signed the bill into law, and it is indeed major, major legislation. Let's take a look at what this bill does. It is a more than $430 billion package expected to reduce the deficit by over $300 billion over 10 years. It's expected to raise $737 billion in revenue over 10 years. And it includes $369 billion in investment money for climate and energy policy, $64 billion to extend the Affordable Care Act policy that reduces health insurance costs. So to be more honest, what we can maybe more accurately say is, it slows down the rate of increase for health insurance costs. It includes, importantly, notably, a 15% corporate minimum tax for companies earning over $1 billion a year. This is a subject of much discussion, which is, for individuals, there has been an alternative minimum tax for a long time. And the concept of an alternative minimum tax is you make $1 million personally, you can use deductions and losses and all these different things to offset the full million in taxes, and you end up owing zero. In order to prevent that, something called the alternative minimum tax was established, which says that for a certain level of income, no matter how many deductions and losses you have to offset taxable income, you have to pay some minimum tax. We never had that for corporations. This bill puts that in place at a 15% rate. It also puts in place a 1% tax on stock buybacks done by large corporations. This was something that was a big deal during the pandemic, you may recall, when the Donald Trump coronavirus stimuli packages were enacted. Many corporations from the corporate side of it used the money they got to just buy back their own stock, raising its price. So this bill puts in place a 1% tax when you do stock buybacks. It will reduce drug prices for Medicare recipients. It expects to collect an additional $124 billion from increased IRS enforcement. So there's money in the bill, controversially so for many, to hire more IRS agents. The belief is that those additional agents are going to find tax cheats and recover $124 billion additional dollars. It includes tax credits to incentivize electric cars and electric HVAC systems, as well as other forms of cleaner technology. That's great. And it is expected to cut pollution by around 40% below the 2005 level by 2030. And it also puts in place a $2,000 a year out-of-pocket cap for Medicare recipients. Now, a few thoughts on this. Number one, is this a major legislative accomplishment for Joe Biden? Yes, it is. Will people vote based on this in November? It's not totally clear. We'll see what polling suggests over the next probably 2 to 3 weeks. Regardless of your political persuasion, there are things in this that are beneficial to most of the Americans in the country. For example, the $2,000 out-of-pocket cap for Medicare recipients. Medicare recipients are both Democrats and Republicans. In fact, it's a more conservative group. We know that every older cohort is slightly more conservative in the United States right now. Less pollution is good. Everybody benefits from less pollution, even if you're against green energy or whatever. There are things in here from which everyone benefits, regardless of political persuasion. Now, I want to take a sort of political overview of the Biden administration generally. My philosophy is, generally speaking, to judge presidents by what they do more than by what they don't do. Now, there are exceptions to that. For example, Donald Trump failed to do many things in terms of his COVID response. That is an area where you have an acute situation. And it seems logical to say, look, all these other world leaders did these things. Trump failed to do that. That was an acute thing. But there are people who wrote to me over the last 12 to 24 hours about the Inflation Reduction Act saying, David, this is not good for Biden. What we need to be focusing on with Biden is he hasn't decriminalized marijuana. He hasn't forgiven all student debt. By the way, Joe Biden did forgive a bunch more student debt overnight, and we'll talk about that on the bonus show. Joe Biden did not do XYZ. Right. Trump also didn't decriminalize marijuana. Obama didn't decriminalize marijuana. It seems to me, if we're trying to evaluate a president's performance, none of them decriminalized marijuana, and it sort of zeroes out. I want cannabis decriminalized, to be clear, but it seems weird to me to react to what is clearly a major legislative accomplishment and to say, well, Biden hasn't done this other thing. I tend to judge presidents by the things that they do. And this is a very good thing. This should be screamed from the rooftops on media, social media, et cetera, by Democrats, and remind people you all benefit from things in this bill, even though every Republican in the Senate voted against it. So are there things Joe Biden has not done that I would like to see him do? Absolutely. Have I been critical of Joe Biden's lack of accomplishments? I have 100%. But this is an accomplishment. The jobs numbers are good. The economy is looking very good. Inflation's coming down. The PACT Act has been signed. For people that think this type of thing is good, he has gone and he approved a strike that killed Al-Qaeda terrorist Ayman al-Zawahiri. Many of you have concerns about due process. I share those concerns. These are the things he has done. And it makes absolute and perfect sense to give him credit for those. And then compare to the alternative when it comes time, if he runs for re-election. What would this other person who is eventually going to be the Republican nominee, what would they have done in this situation? They wouldn't have passed the Inflation Reduction Act. They likely would not have passed the PACT Act. They wouldn't have done a lot of the things Joe Biden did that are good. And then we evaluate, well, is it worthy of re-election? That's a question for down the road. We don't even know if Biden is running. Rudy Giuliani is now reportedly panicking, and his priority is to die a free man, to die a free man. That doesn't sound like things are going particularly well. Rudy Giuliani is now being forced to appear before a Georgia grand jury investigating the Trump and associates' attempts to overturn the results in November of 2020, results in which Joe Biden won Georgia. Let me say that in a very clear way. Joe Biden won Georgia, so Joe Biden should have gotten and did get the electoral votes from Georgia. However, Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani and Jenna Ellis and a whole bunch of different people, Lindsey Graham, were to different degrees and in different ways lobbying for Trump to get those electoral votes. That would have been wrong. Rudy Giuliani now has to appear before a grand jury. He tried having his lawyers say he can't travel. Rudy travels all the time. Didn't make any sense. Judge didn't buy it. He is arguably going to try to say that everything he did was as the lawyer for Trump and therefore it's protected by attorney-client privilege. It doesn't seem like it's necessarily going to work. But we now are being told that Rudy is concerned that he may not die a free man. That is very, very serious.
Well, Ken, I want to start with you.
Sure.
As someone who worked for Rudy Giuliani, John did also, but you were Rudy Giuliani's press secretary, the target now of this investigation. Mm-hmm. That's a big deal.
It's a big deal, and he's trying to create a smokescreen and delay as long as possible. Listen, Rudy flew too close to the sun. He got too close to Trump. He got burned.
He flew too close to the sun on the wings of MAGA Trumpism, and you can't do that and avoid getting burned forever.
Jay works. He knows how the FBI works. He knows these are meticulous investigations. I know this is not a popular position with the media, but I think we should take a wait and see that the affidavit shouldn't be released. I'm doubling back to the earlier conversation. I know he's nervous. He could have flown to Georgia. He flies all over the world.
Yep.
So that's just a typical tactic to try to postpone the inevitable.
Why do you think he's nervous about this Georgia investigation?
Because he knows the truth. He knows he lied to legislators. He knows that he concocted this false elector scheme. He knows he lied for his client. And he knows we all know. It's clear.
What's his next move?
Delay. Kick the can down the road. At this point in his life, his goal is to die a free man.
Can you imagine? Look at how quickly Rudy, who was Mayor 9/11, beloved by everybody, even many Democrats, and all of a sudden it's, am I going to die in prison or am I going to die a free man?
Pretty stark, John.
That is stark. And look, it highlights, I think, the tragedy of his trajectory. But it's a self-inflicted tragedy.
True.
You know, the deal is that Rudy was, as Ken knows, really one of the most respected legal minds of his generation. I remember him telling me many times that, you know, the law is about a search for the truth. And that is not what he is pursuing right now.
No.
He's trying to evade the truth because he's afraid of what will come up. Now, he is saying, look, I was acting in the capacity as lawyer. And whether ex-president ultimately throws him under the bus is yet to be seen. But I will also say that Rudy Giuliani is someone who said many times on tape from the Blue Room at City Hall that, you know, you respect the sanctity of a grand jury. They know more than we do. And so to push back against that as aggressively as he has and to throw around terms like fascist state is beneath the man he was and the credibility he once had.
To be clear, Bernarda, about the luck he's going to have pursuing this, yes, delay, but success probably not. I mean, the judge has said, fake electors, you have to comply.
Yep.
Congressman Jody Heiss, you have to comply.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Senator Graham, you have to show up.
Exactly. So with Rudy Giuliani, you can run, but you can't hide. Your time is up. You have now graduated to being a target. And now it's your time to appear before this grand jury. He can plead the fifth. Yes. He can decide, oh, attorney-client privilege. But then you have the crime fraud exception. But there's so much that can go on.
So bottom line here, it's sort of a sad tale about Rudy Giuliani in a sense. I mean, on a personal level, it is sad. You've got a guy who's, I think, 76, 77 years old, something like that. He did have, even though he was not my political preference, he did have a good career prosecuting the mafia, followed by being mayor of 9/11, and after the mayor of New York City during 9/11, the mayor of 9/11 sounds really bad. The mayor of New York City during 9/11, widely seen, as was George W. Bush, as participating in sort of bringing the nation together and handling it well. And then it started to get a little weird, where Rudy would not stop talking about 9/11, no matter what the question was, for years after he was mayor. And then he attached his wagon to Trump's horse. And that is a hell of a horse to attach your wagon to. And it is self-inflicted. So it can be both sad and also correct that Rudy now has to deal with this. He did things that he knew were the wrong things to do in terms of telling lies, etc. And he's going to have to face the consequences. These clips are all on our Instagram, which you can find by searching Instagram for David Pakman Show. Today, we're going to be speaking with attorney Mark Bankston, who's a partner at Farrah and Ball and is lead counsel in several defamation lawsuits against Alex Jones and InfoWars. Some people may recognize him from dozens and dozens and dozens of viral YouTube videos that we all looked at extensively. Mark, great having you on today.
Hey, thanks for having me, David.
So how did you end up doing these cases and representing a variety of different plaintiffs here in defamation against Alex Jones and InfoWars?
I'm glad you asked me that because, you know, a lot of people just start and end with these Sandy Hook cases. But the first lawsuit I actually brought against Jones was for a young man in the Boston area who was inexplicably accused of being the Parkland shooter in the 2018 shootings in Florida.
Yep.
And at that time, I was in touch with this young man, and he had never even been to Florida. It turned out that he was accused on 4chan of being the Parkland shooter, and it was because he was wearing a communist-themed T-shirt. He had the comedy T-shirt that's the communist leaders with lampshades on their heads drinking from solo cups. So visual pun on Communist Party. Well, InfoWars just ran with that because they were so excited that they could claim that the shooter was a communist. And they took this kid's picture who was being teased on 4chan and put it all over the world. Mm. He reached out to me, and we brought suit back in March of 2018. And when we did that, and that made national headlines, several Sandy Hook parents picked up the phone. And they said, you know, we've been trying to get somebody to bring these suits for us, somebody who would take on Alex Jones. People were saying it's too hard or it's too big of a fight. We need to find a lawyer who would do it. And I said, you found one.
So in general, with these types of cases, what is it you have to prove to actually be able to prevail in a case? Because it's not just that a statement was pejorative, but there are specific requirements that have to be met. And do they vary state by state?
They do a little bit, right? Our common law of defamation is as old as the Magna Carta, but every state has a little bit different rules. But it basically boils down to this. You have to prove three things. You have to prove that they published a false statement. And that the second thing you have to prove is that it was of or concerning a specific individual. And the third thing you have to prove is that that false statement caused them some sort of damages. And it's interesting because, you know, these cases actually ended up having default judgments on the liability, but it was never really something we needed. It was sort of, you know, in a lot of cases that would be an enormous victory. But in this case, it was never going to be difficult to prove that Alex Jones published false statements about these people that caused them damages. This case was always about how much Alex Jones needed to be punished.
When it comes to the judgment that you obtained, which made a number of headlines at close to $50 million, there are state limits on what can actually be collected. Is that correct? I mean, what is it looking like will actually be the liability for Jones of the $49 million?
It's interesting because everyone's talking about this right now, and most of the people who are talking about it are not familiar with Texas law. There is a punitive damage cap statute that was passed by the legislature. However, it does not apply under all factual situations. There are large amounts of exceptions to it.
Okay.
We are going to be moving for the entry of judgment sometime later this week, and we'll have a hearing with the court soon. And we're very confident that those caps aren't going to apply. There are several reasons why under this case, and those will be discussed at the hearing coming up, but we believe it will be the full $50 million verdict. The defendants are going to try to argue a cap applies, which basically limits us to $750,000 in additional damages per claim per defendant.
Okay.
There are three claims with two defendants each. That would be a practical cap of $4.5 million. At the end of the day, with costs and the interest, it would be a total verdict of about $10 million. But we actually do believe that we're going to have going to be able to get around those caps with the exceptions, and that we'll be collecting the entire $50 million verdict.
What's your best assessment of the real financial situation at this point of Alex Jones and InfoWars? Because as many of in my audience know, there has been an assertion of bankruptcy. And as the judge in your case astutely pointed out, just because you claim bankruptcy doesn't mean you actually are bankrupt. There are some statements I've seen from Jones basically copping to the reality that it's a strategic move specifically to try to limit the amount that can actually be collected from him in this and maybe in other cases. What's your best assessment of his financial position?
It's a real difficult question to answer. You know, we had some very limited and contradictory evidence on that at trial. And we know that his revenues are enormous, but what's harder to understand is what's gone on behind the scenes.
Right.
We have now started to encounter some very disturbing evidence that is showing Mr. Jones has been pulling millions and millions out of his business after these default judgments. In fact, in just this last year, Jones used his business like a cash machine to the tune of $60 million that he removed from the company. We really don't know what is all there, but we know there is a very significant amount of money. We feel, though, that by the end of all of these lawsuits, you know, there's eight more plaintiffs up in Connecticut. I have two more I'm taking to trial in a Sandy Hook case, plus another case with that Parkland case. We're pretty sure these verdicts are going to wipe him out. But actually chasing him down for that money and the collections process may become as interesting as the lawsuits themselves.
In a case like this, if someone just sort of like doesn't wire the money, for lack of a better term, what mechanisms are there? Like, you know, in evictions, eventually the men with guns show up and kick you out sort of thing.
Right.
But like what ultimately happens in a case like this?
Well, if it was a normal case and we were collecting outside of bankruptcy, we have lots of tools at our disposal. We can do a writ of execution that essentially sends the sheriff over to InfoWars and starts seizing computers and cameras.
Mm.
Those are the tools that you would normally have at your disposal. But this bankruptcy proceeding is going to be very interesting. Because now you're going to have a federal bankruptcy judge and a U.S. trustee who are overseeing the financial scrutiny of InfoWars. That process itself is going to be very, very dangerous for Mr. Jones. And we are, I think by the end of all of that, we're not going to need to resort to sending sheriffs out. We think the federal enforcement processes in the bankruptcy court are going to divide up the Joneses empire.
When you say pulling money out of businesses, is that and kind of running it through various LLCs? Is it all domestic? Do you have evidence that money is being offshored?
No, you're thinking way too high level. You're thinking like that they're sophisticated financial operators.
Yeah.
I'm literally talking about just money straight drawn out of the company like it's an ATM and put into Jones's hands.
Cash.
$60 million cash taken out of the company. Not routed through another LLC, not anything like this, but denoted on the balance sheets purely as a member draw. And Jones is the only member of Free Speech Systems. So he really is just using the company like a piggy bank. Where exactly that money went and what happened to it is some questions that are going to be answered in the coming months.
And again, you're talking about physical cash?
I don't, you know, that's harder to say. That really is. I sort of don't suspect that there was giant briefcases full of $60 million.
Right.
Like I have to think that there was some sort of electronic transfer into certain accounts. What we don't know yet is what accounts those went to. We know since that it was member draws that that money was paid out to Alex Jones. But where it went from there is very difficult to know yet.
So there were all sorts of just things that to me were unprecedented. I had never seen before, like, for example, that there was a running commentary on InfoWars about the case as it was going on. And then there were exhibits brought in from during the trial, which were about the judge, about the jury, et cetera. How did you even manage this? Was it just like even during the trial, you needed a team watching every minute that was produced and broadcast?
Absolutely. And I had one, luckily. One stepped up. As you know, we're in court all day. We can't do that.
Right.
You may be familiar with Dan Friesen of the podcast Knowledge Fight, who I would consider maybe the world's foremost authority on Alex Jones. He had actually joined on as a consulting expert pro bono very early in the case.
Mm.
And he and the Knowledge Fight team during the days of trial would keep track of what was said, clip out the parts that we were interested in and provide them to us. Those became exhibits in the courtroom. And it's really funny when you think about it that those things almost get lost in the details. There's so many people talking about, for instance, Jones ambush on the stand about his text messages, and it almost gets forgotten that there were videos of them accusing the judge of pedophilia,
right,
and saying that the trial was rigged and that the jurors are a bunch of blue-collar yokels who don't understand what's going on. If that had happened in any other trial, that would be the top story. That would be the headline. But there's so much that went on in this trial that almost gets lost in the details.
So the text message thing, for people who may not have seen or don't remember, there was this incredible situation where for days you were sort of setting up a number of different denials about Alex Jones having had text messages specifically related to Sandy Hook on his phone. Then it turned out you actually had a digital copy of what was on his phone because his attorney accidentally, as far as we know, sent that digital copy to you. And this became a huge flashpoint in the trial, and corporate media covered it, et cetera. First question, at any point, did you think that maybe it was a deliberate accident in order to either try to argue for a mistrial or in some way manipulate the situation in their favor?
I knew that it wasn't deliberate in the sense that it was a strategy in Mr. Jones's favor. I knew that. I will admit that very briefly, I had the same sort of wild ideas in my head that Roger Stone has been spreading the last few days of, is Andino Renault an agent of the deep state for, you know, used to work at the DOJ for Eric Holder? Is he screwing over Alex Jones some way? Mm. In a couple of seconds, though, you realize, no, that's wild, wild thinking. The reality of it is you had an attorney who was not used to doing civil law, decided he was going to take some money to come in and represent Alex Jones purely for the fame and attention, and he was not able to protect his client's data like he needed to. Those were not, in my eyes, intentional moves or strategic moves. They were actually very serious breaches of his duties to his client. And that just sometimes happens when somebody's in over their head like this.
There was a large, an hour or so at least that I remember, during which a number of requests were made by Alex Jones' counsel of the judge when it came to that digital copy. And I didn't fully grasp the sort of fundamentals of what it was that they were asking for on the basis that that record was accidentally sent to you. What was it that they were asking for, and why was it that it was not granted by the judge?
Well, it's funny that you say you were having trouble figuring out what they were asking for, because so were we.
Okay.
They were asking for things that made no sense in the context. They wanted the judge to just do a blanket sealing order over the entire documents, but they had no basis to just suddenly seal 2.3 gigabytes of information. That's not how these rules work.
Okay.
They actually had 10 days from the time of disclosure to specifically identify any documents that either had a legal privilege, like they were between attorney, they were husband and wife, something like that, or that were confidential because they were a trade secret or sensitive in some way. And they just didn't do it. And so when they came into the court having violated all the rules to do that, and then were essentially saying that my side had somehow acted improperly, that was quickly dismissed by the judge. She actually did give them the opportunity to in a day, designate anything as confidential, mm-hmm. which means that I could still have it. I just couldn't share it outside the courtroom. They actually didn't do any of that. So the second day of those hearings, the last day of trial, basically, the judge declared them free and clear. They're in my hands now.
Is
become some bad news for Mr. Jones.
Could Mr. Jones argue against the ultimate judgment on the basis that his counsel inadequately represented him?
Interestingly, no. You have that option in criminal law.
Okay.
If your criminal defense lawyer provides you ineffective assistance, that is a basis for appeal. But in civil law, it is not. And I think it's a good rule, because I think it'd be rare that a criminal lawyer would intentionally throw a case because his client's going to end up in jail. But in a civil case, it's more foreseeable. And so we don't let ineffective assistance be the basis of their defense. Particularly in criminal law, a lot of people have appointed counsel. They can't choose who their lawyer is. Mr. Jones got to choose this lawyer.
You revealed on the Young Turks last week when speaking to our friend Anna Kasparian that in that digital copy, there was a nude photo of Alex Jones' wife sent to Roger Stone. And since then, Erica Wolf Jones came out and said that it was non-consensual. It's not clear to me whether she means that the picture was taken non-consensually or she knew about the picture, but it was not consensual to send it to Roger Stone. What on earth is going on when it comes to this? This is almost like a side story, but raising a ton of different questions about the relationship between Jones and Stone and just bizarre things that you often just never even see become part of a trial. Is there anything else on that that you've since found out?
I mean, the only thing that I can say that I can help clarify the record on that is because Jones is actually, what I found was interesting is after I discussed that, Jones actually showed the picture on his show, which I thought was strange. But what I can tell you is from the nature of the picture, it was definitely consensually taken, right? It wasn't something that he was creep-shotting her or something like that. The non-consent issue comes that it was sent apropos of nothing to Roger Stone. And what seems to be a bid for his attention that was totally ignored by Stone. Just a random picture that was sent in some other messages trying to get his attention. As terms of what's going on in the future with those kinds of issues, because I brought that to the fore because it does look like a crime. And that's not an okay thing to do.
Oh, is that right? So it would be that it's right. Even if the picture was taken consensually, to disseminate it is potentially criminal.
Correct. And I mean, there's some caveats to that in Texas. There has to be basically an intent to harm or embarrass or something like that. But sending your wife's picture to Roger Stone non-consensually pretty much meets that definition. And so, you know, I'm glad that Miss Wolf Jones knows about that now. And there's a lot of other things in those text messages that will likely come out in due course, which raise other troubling issues in Mr. Jones's life. And so as that process goes forward, there may very well be more revelations about what's going on there.
Do you think I might have a defamation case against Alex Jones? He did call me a predator about 6 months ago because I have a paid membership program on my show where people can pay and get access to an extra 20-minute show a day. I can't really say that I was damaged by it. In fact, it was probably the best possible thing that's ever happened, to be honest. I probably don't have a case, right?
No, I would figure not for a couple of reasons. One is you're very much a public figure now. Mm. You know, you are a guy involved in the middle of the discourse. And in this country, we let you be pretty reckless right up to the edge about public figures. A little bit different than the Sandy Hook parents, right? But it's also funny that I just find it ironic that here you are talking about a promotion program you're doing on your show for more content.
Right.
And here's a guy who's hawking, you know, super male vitality and brain force. And he's calling you a predator. That's really funny to me. I think it's also funny you bring this up because somebody was asking me today to explain, said, who's David Pac-Man? What's the show about? Obviously an older person who is not watching their news on the internet.
Sure.
And the best thing I could come up with was, imagine if Alex Jones wasn't bad.
Right.
Imagine if somebody was doing news and commentary on the internet in an independent way that wasn't just a grift to try to sell you pills that turn you red.
Right. Right?
Like, what if you had that? And I'm you know, that's one of the reasons I went on TYT. One of the reasons I was really happy to come here.
Yeah.
Is because the solution sure isn't through the corporate media. It's through shows like this and by people who are taking it seriously, being responsible.
Well, I appreciate that. Last thing I want to ask you about. The last time I was in the same room with Alex Jones was years ago at a radio conference called the New Media Seminar, which I don't even know if it exists anymore. And at the time, my impressions were, he's playing a character. My impressions were that he got off the stage after giving a sort of animated but still kind of normal speech. And he said something like, you know, I could have really freaked him out if I wanted to. And it seemed that he sort of understood that the on-air persona was not at all his sort of real life. In the last 2 years, from everything I've seen and read and interactions with Jones out in public that people have, it's increasingly seeming like the InfoWars Alex Jones is the real guy. In your experience, having been in the room with him for as long as you were, is it a character or is that the real Alex Jones?
You know, that is a question I have struggled with since the beginning. And at the start, I thought I knew the answer. And I think that has changed over time for me.
Hmm.
It's you see, at first I was positive, and I still remain very positive, that most of the things he said, for instance, about Sandy Hook, he never believed. He never believed there were pictures of the children still alive. He never really believed the school was shut down and stalked and was a fake school. I don't think he believed any of that. And so there was a time that I really believed that he was a sophisticated operator, completely detached from the things he was saying. But as we went through this whole process, I deposed him several times. As we went through trial, I also realized there is no off switch for Jones. And there is a something about spending every day wrapped in your own BS that it starts to actually affect you. And there is a mindset. Jones, I think you're right when you say that he is conscious of how his words appear to people. He wants to try to control that. But here we just saw him in this trial, totally unable to turn off the freak flag just for 10 minutes in front of that jury. And it really shows that there's two sides of Jones. There is a very, very conscious manipulator side to Jones. And then there is a side where he is not really in control of himself.
Yeah.
Those two parts of himself are at war. And right now, the part of him that's out of control has been winning handily for the last couple of years.
Yeah, out of control is quite an understatement. Mark Bankston, partner at Farah and Ball and lead counsel in a number of defamation lawsuits against Alex Jones and InfoWars. Mark, really a pleasure having you on today.
Hey, really a pleasure being here. If you ever have legal questions and want to talk about some more stuff, please have me back.
Early last week or middle of last week, I came to you and I told you that Donald Trump is now conducting a frantic and frenetic search for criminal defense attorneys. Why? Well, he and others increasingly believe that an indictment criminally is at least a real possibility, real enough that he truly needs to have criminal defense attorneys ready to go. It appears as though that search is not going particularly well, and there's a few reasons for that. As the Washington Post reports, Trump is rushing to hire seasoned lawyers, but he keeps hearing no. This is just an unbelievable line. The former president's current legal team includes a Florida insurance lawyer who's never had a federal case, a past general counsel for a parking garage company, and a former host at far-right One America News. Can you imagine that as the former president of the United States, this is the struggle that you are experiencing? He is rushing to assemble a team of respected lawyers, but the answer they keep hearing is no. The struggle to find expert legal advice puts Trump in a bind as he faces potential criminal exposure from a records dispute with the National Archives. Everyone is saying no, said a prominent Republican lawyer, who, like some others, spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss confidential conversations. Longtime confidants and advisors of Trump have grown worried about Trump's current stable of lawyers, noting most of them have little to no experience in cases of this type, according to two people familiar with the discussions. Taylor Budowich, a Trump spokesman, defended the quality of the former president's legal team in a statement Tuesday, but it is not particularly good. John Sale, a prominent Florida defense attorney who worked on the Watergate prosecution team, said he turned down representing Trump because he didn't have enough time. You have to evaluate whether you want to take it. It's not like a DUI. It's representing the former president of the U.S. and maybe the next one in what's one of the highest visibility cases ever. So normally, as the article says, it's prestigious and creates a lot of publicity when you represent a former president. But this is a very different situation. And we have to be able to kind of just say we know what's going on here. Right. I mean, big picture. Look at what has happened to the people that defend Trump. You end up disbarred. You end up subpoenaed. You end up indicted. You're left with an unpaid legal bill at the end of the day. You become ridiculed. I mean, Sidney Powell, I am sure, and Sidney Powell is probably wackier than the people that they've been trying to get to represent Trump. Sidney Powell, I'm sure, believed, this is my ticket to legal fame. This is my ticket to legal riches. I'm going to get so many clients and it'll be so prestigious and the PR will be great. And then she starts going around with Rudy Giuliani and doing these completely humiliating appearances everywhere. And she ends up disbarred in, I think it was New York and D.C. I don't remember off the top of my head. It doesn't go particularly well. Look at what happened to Michael Cohen. Look at what happened to Giuliani, Sidney Powell, I mentioned, and others. Eric, I forget the guy's last name, and all these different people who have represented Trump. It doesn't go well. And he often doesn't pay. Now, we learned that the Republican National Committee has been paying some of Trump's legal bills for a period of time. And we talked about why when we discussed that. But it is not a guarantee that you will even be paid for your work. Remember the story about one of the law firms that Trump had representing him years ago. They would always send two people whenever they had a meeting because Trump would often lie about what he said to his own attorneys in previous meetings. So they wanted two people there so that they could counter the falsehoods and correct the lies. These were confidential meetings with his own lawyers, and Trump would still lie. And of course, as a more general thing in representing Trump, one of the biggest problems with him as a client is he can't just shut up. He can't just say nothing. And if you think back to the Russia probe, the Mueller probe, whatever you want to call it, if Trump had never said anything and not attempted to obstruct or tamper with witnesses or any of it, if Trump had just said, I am busy being president. I will allow the investigation to run its course. It would have been over much faster, and Trump would have been under much less legal jeopardy. And so it's hilarious. Typically, representing a former president would be a tremendously prestigious and great thing to do, and lucrative. But it seems like representing Trump is none of those things and couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. Tucker Carlson is now starting to prepare his audience for what he believes is an indictment of Donald Trump that is coming. Now, there's a couple different reasons why Tucker Carlson may be doing this. One of the reasons may be that he is trying to soften the blow and preemptively sort of deflate what may be coming so that when it happens, he can say, we knew this was going to happen. This is part of the scam. It's part of the witch hunt, whatever. Tucker Carlson seems to be pretty friendly with Trump right now. You might remember that a few weeks ago at this, Saudi-backed LIV golf tournament, L-I-V golf tournament at Bedminster in, I think it's Jersey. Tucker Carlson and Marjorie Taylor Greene and Trump were photographed together hanging out. So Tucker clearly has some kind of vested interest in this. And he is now kind of just saying as an aside, the indictment's coming. It's not even if, it's more a matter of when.
There's nothing to see here. That's the line. And no doubt Asa Hutchinson and Mitch McConnell and Dan Crenshaw and the rest of them will be telling you the very same thing when the Biden Justice Department or some other state law enforcement agency under their influence finally does what you know they're going to do, which is indict Donald Trump. Obviously, they're going to do that.
So the point here is saying these people are so biased. These people are so in the tank against Trump. They are so viciously determined to damage him that the indictment is coming, but it's going to be a bogus indictment. It's not going to be based on anything.
Who knows how? Maybe they'll produce surveillance video from Mar-a-Lago. Apparently, they've already subpoenaed that. We'll spend the next year talking about how it shows Trump mishandling classified information. Really? On the server? Remember the endless Russia collusion hoax? We're in for a lot more of that.
The endless Russia collusion hoax, which led to 37 indictments and so many people ultimately pleading guilty that it recovered more money than it cost to run that investigation. That's the witch hunt Tucker is talking about. That's revisionist history.
They'll scream at how Trump is a criminal. And if you express any support for him or any interest in retaining, I don't know, the rights of free speech and due process, you're a criminal too.
Now, of course, Trump's rights of free speech have not been restricted in any way by those investigating him. It is true that he was banned by Twitter 2 years ago, has nothing to do with the investigation, has nothing to do with the First Amendment, private company with terms of service. But that Trump has been saying whatever he wants and he can get interviewed wherever he wants, at least in right-wing media, anytime he wants. And in terms of due process, all the I's have been crossed and T's dotted. I know, as Sean Hannity said last week.
In fact, you are the threat. You're the threat. And just mentioning that you disagree with what is happening is an attack on our government. Mm. That's their style. Just the other day, after signing off of the Mar-a-Lago raid, your attorney general, Merrick Garland, came on stage to whine about how actually he was the victim here. He's the victim. Apparently, some people disagreed with the raid. So the FBI, the most heavily armed domestic law enforcement agency in the world, is now under threat from you.
Well, yes, that is absolutely true. There were death threats to FBI agents. Gunmen showed up at FBI offices, including in Cincinnati. Tucker is completely unhinged. And he wants us to believe that the victim here is Trump. Trump's had his free speech taken away. No, he hasn't. Trump's had due process denied. No, he hasn't. And it's really Trump that is the victim. So there's the view from Tucker. Tucker, who recently hung out with Trump at his golf club. He is in a position to give us a really honest and unbiased assessment. Now, the other thing that I think is interesting is the right seems to be talking much more about an indictment than the left. Many on the left are sort of resigned to a possible fate, which is this isn't going to go anywhere in terms of indictments. The right continues to say, oh, they're going after this guy. I was looking at the conservative subreddit the other day, and they're going on and on about how there's a secret grand jury in D.C. that's imminently going to indict Trump. Why are they starting rumors about their own guy going down? Is it a sort of negative visualization in the style of the Stoic philosophers? I don't think so. Is it about diffusing the power of the indictment when it eventually comes, because then it looks more like a plot rather than actual justice and due process? Maybe. Or is it all to rile up the extremists so that some of them commit the stochastic terrorism that many of us fear is coming, solely because the possibility of violence may actually interfere with the investigation? And when there is actual violence, it's probably useful to many of the people that are supporting Donald Trump globally, to put it lightly. I don't know the answer, but you're hearing a lot more indictment talk from the right than from the left. So there's Tucker's view. If you think Tucker is able to fairly assess the situation, that's his perspective, that an indictment is coming, but it is a bogus indictment. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192-DAVID-P. Here's a voicemail about the horrifying Salman Rushdie stabbing, which we talked about on yesterday's bonus show. This voicemail is from the Eggman, who we have not heard from for at least a few weeks, if not a month or two.
Hey, Dave, I make a prediction that we will never see Salman Rushdie in public ever again. Mm. Either he is passed away or they're going to say he's dead. Or he's going to fake his own death. That's it. We'll never see him again. I hope he's okay, but that's my prediction. Shalom, brother.
Yeah. So since the Eggman left that voicemail, the reports are that Salman Rushdie's condition has improved, which is great. He is now, I believe, if I understand the last medical report, expected to survive. He's 75 years old. And despite the fatwa officially being formally being rescinded, we all knew he was still at risk, does a public appearance, and he gets stabbed. It would be perfectly logical for Salman Rushdie to never show his face in public again. And it's sad that that's the reality of the situation. But there is a contingent of people determined to see Rushdie dead. And so, I mean, faking his own death or simply never appearing in public again, honestly, the situation is so crazy that it all seems somewhat rational if he were to do something like that. For now, let's just continue hoping for his recovery. We have a great bonus show for you today. We will talk about the complete and total backfire of the Mehmet Oz crudité video, which, by the way, I covered months and months ago. It's not a new video, but it's gone viral. The Biden administration has canceled almost $4 billion in student debt for more than 200,000 borrowers. We'll tell you who and why. And the NBA, the National Basketball Association, has decided it will not hold games on Election Day in order to encourage people to vote. And of course, right-wingers are furious, even though the NBA is just saying, just go vote. We're not telling you who to vote for. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Get access by signing up.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call, jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Bolsonaro, you didn't believe in medicine. You believed in your lie. Because if there's someone who is possessed by the devil, it is Bolsonaro. He's a liar like I've never seen anyone lie.
Former Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has formally announced his campaign to challenge Brazil's far-right president Jair Bolsonaro in October's election. Fear is growing Bolsonaro might try to stay in office even if he loses. We'll get the latest. Then we'll look at the recent murder of British journalist Dom Phillips and indigenous researcher Bruno Pereira in Brazil's Amazon rainforest and what it says about Bolsonaro, who once vowed, quote, there won't be one more inch of indigenous reserve. We'll speak to an indigenous lawyer who just came to Washington to talk to lawmakers after helping to lead a search and rescue mission for the two men.
When the president dismantles public policies and public institutions that should serve indigenous rights, when the government persecutes its civil servants whose mandate it should be to protect the indigenous peoples and the policies applied to them, we become more vulnerable.
Then the territory. That's the title of a stunning new documentary looking at the struggle of the indigenous Uruoeo-Wawau people in Rondônia to save their land in the Brazilian rainforest from illegal settlers, farmers, and loggers.
This forest and its rivers are our home. They give us life. The Uruoeo-Wawau territory is like a barrier against deforestation. Everything's gone.
Much of the footage was filmed by Brazilian indigenous activists themselves during the pandemic. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A top United Nations official has warned fighting in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region has spawned the worst humanitarian disaster on Earth. World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, who's originally from Tigray, said the conflict, which first erupted in late 2020, now threatens the lives of millions, even as global leaders largely ignore the crisis.
I can tell you that the humanitarian crisis in Tigray is more than Ukraine, without any exaggeration. And I said it many months ago, maybe the reason is the color of the skin of the people in Tigray.
Dr. Tedros's remarks Wednesday came as Ethiopian officials called for a formal ceasefire agreement to end nearly 2 years of fighting with separatists in Tigray, where some 6 million people have been largely cut off from the outside world for months, unable to access food, medicine, and other necessities. The Tigray People's Liberation Front has so far rejected the peace proposal, calling it obfuscation meant to distract from ongoing fighting. The United Nations warns the Tigray conflict has combined with a worsening drought across Ethiopia to threaten the lives of 20 million people. In Ukraine, Russian strikes on the northeastern city of Kharkiv overnight left at least 12 people dead and dozens more injured. In the deadliest of the attacks, a three-story residential building was flattened after it took a direct hit from a Russian missile. Video of the aftermath showed rescue workers sifting through the rubble of the building, which once housed about 50 people.
As a result of the midnight hour, we have 7 dead and 16 wounded as a result of the rocket hit. These are the people who are inside the building who survived, and also people who are in buildings nearby who sustained varying degrees of injuries from shrapnel, glass, and other things.
Human Rights Watch has condemned Russia's assault on Kharkiv, accusing it of